Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
What happens when a huge Chinese container ship, trying to make its way through the fog-shrouded night of San Francisco's bay, scrapes against the piling of the Bay Bridge, ripping a long gash that cuts into the fuel tanks and releases 58,000 gallons of toxic fuel into this historic landmark and ecosystem? You'll find out about this and more when your Voice of the Earth continues here on the Wild Side News. It seems we hear of a new natural or environmental disaster every few days. Less than 2 weeks ago, the Chinese COSCO Busan, an enormous container ship, hit one of the massive pilings of the Bay Bridge, and the bridge won, cutting a long, deep gash in the massive cargo ship, which quickly turned into the area's worst environmental disaster in decades. Within moments, the response script began unfolding, as the Coast Guard was alerted to a spillage estimated at 140 gallons of fuel. An immediate series of predetermined actions were initiated. Following today's Nature News, we'll be talking with Cheryl Surface, who was one of those called as a first responder to be part of the lead team charged with addressing this monumental disaster. We on the outside must rely on getting our information from the media. We see the images, hear the news clips, and moan and squirm as the size and scope of the disaster unfolds. Cheryl Surface, however, must act, and act quickly, to contain the spill, protect sensitive sites, and administer the myriad response teams who are suddenly thrust literally onto and into the waters to mop up the toxic goo. It's a daunting task, the scope of which may not be effectively portrayed during our news bites, as you'll hear following this week's Nature News update. So now, the news. As gas prices surge ahead to keep pace with the record-breaking oil prices, which are expected to hit $100 any day now, others are already beginning to lay the groundwork for prices of $125 and $150 a barrel. Robert Mabro, director of the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies, who advises OPEC on pricing trends and strategies, said he did not know if the $100 benchmark is sustainable, and predicted that with such crazy prices causing uncertainty in the oil futures market, oil prices could easily rise $20 or $30 per barrel. Mr. Mabro said that it's reasonable to expect that prices could range up to $150 before too long. United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon has challenged the world's policymakers to start devising a comprehensive plan for tackling climate change at next month's summit in Bali, Indonesia, after a United Nations report released November 17th found that global warming is unequivocal and could cause irreversible damage to the planet. Launching the fourth assessment report of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, IPCC, which brings together hundreds of scientific experts, Mr. Ban said that slowing and even reversing the effects of climate change is the defining challenge of our age. He also stressed the report makes clear that concerted and sustained action now can still avoid some of the most catastrophic scenarios in the IPCC forecasts. A new study suggests that a holistic approach is needed in assessing the potential environmental and health effects of toxic effluents from industry. The researchers point out that the prediction of wastewater toxicity usually does not take into account any possible interactions between the compounds in the wastewater sample. The presence of a particular chemical may make another more easily absorbed by aquatic creatures or plants, for instance. Moreover, some highly toxic chemicals may be undetected in a complex wastewater mixture. 4 days after Super Cyclone Sidr killed more than 2,400 people in Bangladesh, rescuers were struggling to reach isolated areas along the country's devastated coast and give aid to millions of survivors. Media reports and the chairman of the Bangladesh Red Crescent Society, Mohammed Abdur Rab, said the death toll had already surpassed 3,000 and was likely to go up. The government put the official toll at 2,471 confirmed dead. While it will take several days to determine the number of dead and missing, some 3 million survivors who were either evacuated from the low-lying southern coast or whose homes and villages were destroyed will need support, the government said. And that's the news. And a few announcements. The Wildside News has a new broadcast schedule, moving its airing day from each Thursday to each Tuesday. Join in then, or anytime, so that you can know you are tuned in. And now to today's feature. On Wednesday, November 7th, there was an accident in the San Francisco Bay that resulted in a major oil spill, particularly in an area like that, right in the middle of a metropolitan area, as well surrounded by very sensitive natural areas. And there was an immediate response to try to deal with this extraordinary crisis. And here we are, a week and a half later, and to some extent, that incident is under control, and the process now is where do we go from here and the cleanup from this point forward. I'm very pleased to have on the Wildside News now someone who was absolutely involved from day one in trying to organize and plan the recovery effort following the oil spill by the Costco Busan. Cheryl Surface, who is talking to us now from Reno. Cheryl, welcome to the Wildside News.
Thank you.
Cheryl, you work with a group called the O'Brien's Group, which was called immediately upon the notification that there was this spill. Why don't you talk about why that is, the O'Brien's Group, what they do, then we'll talk about what your process was that led to this time and where we go from here.
Thank you, Sydney. The O'Brien's Group is a responsible contractor, and based on the regulations of the Oil Pollution Act of 1990, vessels who transport hazardous materials must identify a local-based response contractor who, should they have an accident or an event, is located in the United States and can be responsible for the oversight and deployment in response to the accident. And the O'Brien's Group is one of those. Throughout the United, they have clients throughout the United States that they respond to their events, should they have them.
Now, you're actually a subcontractor with the O'Brien's Group. They call on you because you have quite a bit of experience in crisis management.
Well, my background is basically in the fire service, and I spent 25 years in the fire service, and primarily that was in Alaska. So in 1989, when the vessel Exxon Valdez had an accident resulting in the regulations that are in place now, there was a group of us from the fire service that moved into doing training for oil companies as a result of those compliance issues. And so we started doing incident management training using the incident command system for oil clients, primarily in Alaska, and then moved out to other clients throughout the world.
The incident happened on November 7th. When did you get your call from the O'Brien's Group?
As per the regulation, vessel actually called the U.S. Coast Guard since it happened on U.S. Coast Guard waters. The U.S. Coast Guard then is regulated to cascade through the state notifications as well as the responsible party notification. So as soon as the O'Brien's Group received that notification, they then cascaded through their network to not only respond to the incident, so they have contractors in place that responded with skimmers, booms, actual contractors that were going to the incident itself. And subsequently, they put in the call to their network folks to find out their availability for response as far as management for the incident.
You know, an incident like that is an enormous event. If anybody has looked at, for example, the maps of the spread, it really covered most of the bay and headed out into the open waters as well. And we'll talk about that. But it's hard to imagine how in the world a person responds. And you were very much involved in planning from day one. Tell us what some of your first concerns were when you get on the ground.
This particular incident, when the O'Brien's Group received the first call, they immediately activated two response contractors who have vessels and boom capabilities to respond directly to the vessel itself to try and contain the product coming out of the vessel and start actually skimming the product immediately. And then the subcontractors, such as myself, we came in to manage the incident. So literally when I got the call, got on an airplane and flew over to Oakland and responded to the initial command post, which was set up at the Coast Guard facility in Yerba Buena. And I was given a a listing of vessels and personnel and equipment that had been responding to the incident, as well as a listing of equipment, personnel, and supplies that were en route to the incident. And that evening, I was tasked with developing the plan for the next operational period, or the next day, utilizing the resources that were not only on scene, but those that were coming to the incident over the next 24-hour operational period. So that night, we sat in the office and developed a plan and a strategy to implement that plan for November 8th. And we just continued that process throughout the incident.
The COSCO, the Busan, is actually a container vessel, so it's not a tanker ship. But unfortunately, it hit pier and tore a gaping hole in the side of the vessel. And, you know, the stories that I'm hearing through the media, which is my only real source, is that for quite some time, but whoever was steering that craft at that time, it was very dense fog. Didn't quite realize the degree to which the ship had been damaged. And strangely enough, it happened to hit their fuel tanks, which then bled into the bay. Now, this is different than crude oil. This is actually a fuel oil.
Yeah, it is. It's a bunker, and it's actually used as like a gasoline for a car, only it's not a gasoline product. It's a very similar product to a crude oil in visual reference. And it's dark in color, its consistency is thick, and it's not like a diesel or gasoline product, which is very white and flashy fuel. This is a persistent product, and its characteristics look very much like a crude oil when it's on the water.
Mm-hmm.
This particular incident didn't happen in very dense fog. So the first report resulted around the fact that there was very dense fog. It did strike the structure. There was floating timbers in the water. The initial response vessels were responding to a report of a collision with the pier. And when they were on scene, there was floating timbers from the pier along with product. So it's very hard to determine what actually has occurred in the situation such as this where there's dense fog. So immediately they responded to the worst case. So the response vessels that went with their booming strategies and their skimming capabilities responded based on the call. But, of course, we sent everything we had available in the bay at that particular time.
Mm-hmm. Which was a wise decision.
Exactly.
As things developed, originally reports were that it was 150 gallons or so, but it turned out to be much more significant and ultimately 58,000 gallons. That's
well, you've got to understand that the very dense fog, captains on the bridge can't really see over the side of the boat, probably did not have a clear picture of what the extent of the damage to the vessel were, you know, until they were able to move the vessel and actually gauge the tanks and find out how much product released into the environment versus how much product was left in those tanks. They immediately started transferring fuel from the damaged tanks to empty tanks on the vessel.
So you arrive, and you're finding out probably by the time that you got there, you knew that this was a much larger incident. What was your first concern? What do you do at that point to immediately go into action to contain this situation?
Well, from my perspective, I'm the planning section chief, and so I work very hand-in-hand with the unified command and the operations folks in order to make sure that we implement the best operational strategies we can for the next operational period. So when I come, like I said, I got a listing of response vessels and equipment personnel that had previously gone out in the initial call out, that had been cascading in throughout the course of the day, and that we expected to be available for operations at first light the next day. So when I came in to the project that evening on November 7th, my job was basically to put together and document a plan of action for that next operational period to make sure that we had the equipment, personnel, and supplies available to continue the response efforts and build up the response efforts forward from the initial accident.
In terms of planning priorities, what are your concerns?
Well, our first priority, of course, is safety. And our second priority is environmental constraints. And then our third, you know, is economics. But we look at a safety standpoint. So when we're responding to this incident, safety is our number one priority. But then number two, we're looking at the environmental concerns and considerations. So while we're responding with skimming capabilities, we're also responding with booming strategies. So along up and down the entire coastlines and throughout the United States, there are area contingency plans in place And these area contingency plans have been developed with state and federal regulations, and they identify sensitive areas throughout the bay. So as we're responding with skimming capabilities, we're also responding with strategies to protect those environmentally sensitive areas. So we're deploying BOOM at the same time we're skimming product off the water. We're deploying BOOM to protect those sensitive areas. So that had been ongoing from the very beginning of the incident on November 7th, and those continued through November 8th and on throughout the course of numerous days, the skimming and booming strategies were being implemented.
Describe briefly, first about skimming, and then we'll talk about boom. Let's talk about skimming. What's involved with that?
There's different types of skimmers. You know, some of the skimmers are integral to the vessel themselves. So the vessel will move throughout the water and be able to skim up an oily water mixture and put it in a storage tank within the vessel. Some of the skimmers operate with a belt system. So they put very similar to like a conveyor belt in the water, and it has a substance on the belt that actually attracts the oil, and they can move it up and put that oil into a container within the skimmer. There's like weir skimmers that are on the ground that kind of stir it up and bring up the product. So in this particular event, as in all of them, we used a combination of skimmers and a combination of skimming vessels in order to pick up and contain the product.
You mentioned that very soon on in the incident, you start creating the booms. We'll talk about those and how they work and then the priority in terms of their placement.
The response vessels that go out, not only are they capable of skimming, they're also capable of booming. And then we have vessels that just are booming vessels. The booming strategies are, like I said, they're identified in the area contingency plan as far as the environmental sensitivity goes. So we look at those ACPs and we boom according to the environmentally sensitive areas. So there's different types of boom. There's a hard boom that looks very similar. It's usually yellow in color if you visually see it. And it looks kind of like an inflatable life vest, so to speak. And that basically, you anchor it to the shoreline or you anchor it to the bottom of the bay, and you basically string it out in a long line, and that keeps the oil from encroaching on those particular sensitive locations.
It's a literal physical barrier.
It is. Mm-hmm. And then we also have a sorbent boom, and the sorbent boom is a combination. It's also a barrier, but it also acts to kind of suck up the oil. So it's white in color, looks very much like a little white sausage that goes across. Same thing, anchoring strategies to hold it in place. And then that sorbent boom then can be deployed in various locations.
Now, the first priority for the booms is to protect sensitive areas. Why don't you define some of those areas that perhaps you applied the booms to first off?
Anything that's sensitive as far as species sensitivity, as well as like marshlands, habitat for wildlife, drinking water intake areas, marine like aquarium, you know, things of that nature are defined as sensitive. Most of the sensitive areas are in relationship to the environment. So, you know, species, well, whether it's, you know, birds or mammals or vegetative species that have been, you know, deemed sensitive by the environmental scientists in California.
And in this situation, about how many boom locations did you identify?
There was numerous identified booms, but then, like I said, those are all in the IRA contingency plan, so we started implementing them from the very beginning. Now, a lot of those boom strategies are put in place in relationship to the projection of where the oil may go. So the oil may never have actually reached those areas that we boomed, but we put them in place just as a caution based on the trajectories that we were looking at and where we thought the oil may go.
So you're skimming and you put the booms in place and you're trying to really mop up as much of this as you can and protect the most fragile areas, but you can't protect everything. And so some of the oil, of course, ended up on the beaches themselves. The pictures of that were just horrific, this black tarry goo, and of course the impact on the wildlife. Talk about what's involved in trying to deal with that on the beaches. Let's start with that, first the beaches.
Well, you've got to remember that oil is a dynamic product, so it moves with the tides and currents, and you have some very big fluctuations in the tides in the bay, coming in and out of the bay, and you have a great current activity there, so it does move this product around, even though you're trying your best to skim it. During these skimming operations, we had helicopters in the air moving the skimmers into the product so that we could clean up as much as we could, but some did escape and get on to the shore side. Now, the shore side, you know, you're talking about many different types of shore sides, so you're talking about beaches, riprap rocky areas, you're talking about marshy areas, deers, docks, marinas, that kind of thing. So when we're looking at those, we have to implement different strategies based on those, whatever kind of type of shoreline environment we may be working in. So when we're looking in a big shoreline environment, we have to be very sensitive to the fact that we don't want to do more environmental damage in the cleanup process than actually cleaning up that product. So a lot of times in the shoreline cleanup process, we have scientists, trustees, for instance, National Park Service employees, biologists, those kind of people that are acting as stewards of the land. And so they go out with the cleanup crews and they identify areas that they perhaps want to avoid in the cleanup strategies, or they want to bring in specialized people so that the cleanup can be done in a way, manner that's not going to harm the environment. But so we put together crews, and numerous crews for this particular incident, that would be assigned different beaches, and they would be assigned to clean up and pick up the product. Now, there are regulations by OSHA requiring certain amounts of training requirements in order to deal with the hazardous material. There are certain requirements in disposing of hazardous waste associated with the cleanup activity. So, and then there's a logistical support of those cleanup locations. So all of those things had to be brought into the picture. So this huge effort in putting, you know, over 1,000 people into the field on a daily basis in order to clean up the beaches and the product that was out there.
One of the stories that came out of this, and I so much respect people who care enough for the environment to, it's almost an instinct to go out and do whatever they can, and they did. And you, there were images of citizens out on the beaches working to clean up, and their intentions were absolutely on the mark. Unfortunately, as you say, in some cases, the thing that is most critical is to make sure that in the process of trying to help, you don't do more damage. I think some people may have a hard time really understanding that. Why don't you help us understand it a little farther level here? What's involved and why that is so critical? Give some examples. I think the concept of cleaning up rocks and birds, where people, although they're trying to do the right thing, could actually harm something, and it takes real expertise to know the proper procedures.
For instance, just to let you know, safety is always our number one priority. On any event we go to, safety is the number one priority. In this particular event, you're dealing with a hazardous product. So in the dealing with a hazardous product, there are OSHA regulations in place that require a certain amount of training in order to minimize the responders' harm that can actually happen to them when they're, you know, picking up a hazardous waste. So the other thing that we have to worry about is the disposal of that. So when you're picking up the oil off the beaches, and a lot of people did this, you know, just to go out and help out. Number one, they were not properly, did not have proper protective equipment on, and they would take the oily product and they would just put it in the regular waste receptacles. So, you know, for instance, they would clean up the soil and they would put it in the National Park Service regular trash can. They would take it to their own home and deposit it in their own waste receptacle. So they're transferring that product throughout the whole waste stream in the Bay Area. Now, we treat it as a hazardous product. So in that regard, there are special requirements for us to that regulate the disposal of this hazardous waste. So it created a problem in the fact that, number one, they were exposing themselves without the proper training or the proper personal protective equipment. And number two, they were transferring this product throughout the entire waste stream, throughout the bay. So that meant that I kind of liken it to taking your oil out of your car and just dumping it down your drain, or taking it to the landfill and just dumping it in the landfill. Very similar in that they're transferring the oil from the beach.
Yeah, it expands your challenge. Instead of being able to identify the sort of the natural boundaries of this disaster, it's now spreading out into a larger realm.
Exactly, and I don't think people recognize that that's what they were doing, or certainly they wouldn't have done that. And then the other thing is we have to be environmentally sensitive. So each one of these beaches has its own environmentally sensitive characteristics. For instance, there's plovers on the beach, which when you're looking at that species, you know, you want to make sure that your cleanup efforts are not impacting their nesting areas. There are little lichens and critters that, you know, are identified with riprap areas, and you want to make sure in your cleaning strategies that you're not damaging them more in the cleaning process than perhaps Mother Nature and herself cleaning would do. So we take each one of these beaches and each one of these locations, and we look at them from an environmentally sensitive perspective. So we develop cleanup strategies, and we use different cleanup products and different types of techniques in order to reduce our effect on the environment. smell on the beach, but we know we need to clean this up, but we don't want to further harm the environment with our cleanup. So we work very closely with scientists and environmentalists to make sure that our cleanup strategies are the best for that particular location. I know that there's been some bad press in relationship to this particular incident, but from an on-the-ground and response effort, this has been an incredibly coordinated response. And the agencies and the partners and the contractors in a unified command system really came together to respond to this particular event. And the way that the response was activated and the amount of equipment and personnel and supplies that were cascaded in, it really was an effective response. I've been on numerous ones. This one was a well-coordinated effort to mitigate the environmental damage that was associated with this particular disaster.
I recall when I first looked at the breaking story, I did notice that there were numbers to call. The O'Brien's group also works with specific groups who have expertise, particularly in wildlife recovery in these situations. Talk about how they work with them, and then probably the best way for citizens who have an interest in helping, the best way for them to work with these groups.
Just as when the initial call comes in, the O'Brien's group calls their contractors, the response contractors who take the vessels out there, also underneath the cascade of umbrella of network folks that are in the O'Brien's pocket is the Wildlife Care Network. And the Wildlife Care Network is an organization that responds to incidents to recover boiled birds and mammals. And so the Wildlife Care Network was activated immediately. And in that response, they did provide a number for people who wanted to volunteer in the efforts to be trained in recovering wildlife and then also trained in the cleaning and the rehabilitation and then the release of these particular birds in this case into the environment. So that number was actually posted relatively quickly on how people could volunteer to help in the wildlife recovery.
They get some very hands-on, quick training so that they can be effective volunteers.
Well, you got to remember that you're dealing with wildlife, and so just as we don't want to harm the environment in our cleanup efforts, you certainly don't want to stress or harm the birds in your capturing efforts. So each volunteer has to have a certain amount of training. And so when they're going to capture these boiled wildlife, that they're not actually doing more harm than good.
I can really relate to the concept of trying to do the right thing and ending up stressing a bird. I know a number of years ago I was working at a state park, and there was a pelican stranded on the lake, and it was getting late, and the pelican was supposed to be on its way, and it wasn't. So another naturalist and I went out onto this little pond with our canoes, two canoes, and we thought we'd be able to catch this bird relatively easily. 2 hours later, we had been really making fools of ourselves out there, chasing this poor pelican around, and we were stressing that bird out. We finally did catch the bird, but I was quite amazed at how, although I thought I knew what I was doing, I really didn't have a proper clue of how best to deal with this. And, of course, you're dealing with so many different animals, and one of the stories that I heard as well is that in the process of trying to catch some of the birds, they ended up running wild, heading actually back into the dangerous waters. So proper education and knowing what you're doing is really critical, and trying to really coordinate this, which is what you're working on. Really commend you for that.
Thank you. So this particular effort took place over a 24-hour operational period. They found that by using lighting at night, they were able to mesmerize the wildlife actually, and it would cause less stress than the capture technique if they lit the birds at night and actually were able to capture them that way. So there was a lot of birds on the beaches. There was a lot of collected dead birds on the beaches. Some of the birds were boiled and some were not. So then once they capture this wildlife, they bring them back to the facility. The birds that were oiled are then subjected to an examination to check their overall health, how much they've actually been oiled, and after they undergo the examination, they then go through the cleaning process, which uses Dawn dishwashing detergent, and they use toothbrushes and very gentle cleaning techniques and multiple cleanings of each individual bird, and they take these individual birds once they've been through the cleaning process, and they put them through the drying and fluffing process, and then put them in a holding, kind of little like wet area, you know, they've got water associated with it where they hold the birds, until they're properly rehabilitated and then released. Now, this particular incident has been a real success story in the fact that we've already had a release of birds in, back into the environment down in Half Moon Bay. So birds were picked up, they were cleaned, they were rehabilitated, and then released. That's a success story.
Let's talk about where you are in this process and where do you go from here?
Currently, this particular incident, there is no more recoverable product on the water, and the operations are focusing now on shoreline. And when I say shoreline, I'm talking about different types of shoreline. We have our beaches, we have riprap, we have the marshes and marinas and piers and docks. So the shoreline encompasses multiple different types. And so with each of these different types of shoreline, there's different techniques for cleanup. And as with when we're talking about cleaning up the shoreline, as with marinas and piers and riprap and you know, historical rock walls and that sort of thing, each technique requires a different process. So we work hand-in-hand with scientists to develop the cleaning strategies that can best effectively pick up the product. Now, oil is dynamic. So you may clean a beach one day, and then due to tides and currents and different flow of the ocean, the next day you may come back and find additional tar balls. So this particular incident has now evolved into what we call project management phase, where we have a team of many teams out there that monitor each beach every single day. And when they find product, they clean it up. And we're doing different techniques for cleaning riprap, different techniques for cleaning historical walls, different techniques for marinas and piers. And so just identifying each particular area that needs to be cleaned and the best solution for cleaning and then implementing. And then along with that, there was a lot of vessels moored and anchored in the bay, and each one of those vessels may or may not have been impacted by the event. So in addition to that, we've set up a non-response vessel cleaning program. So even though the vessels weren't involved in the response, they may have been impacted. Pleasure boats, historical boats, ferries, anything that, you know, utilizes the bay could have been impacted by this particular event. So in response to that, the O'Brien's group and the planning and operations section have set up a non-response vessel cleaning protocol standard. And with that, they'll set up different cleaning stations, different techniques for cleaning different vessels, and people will be able to either file a claim for damages to their vessel, or they can also respond and have utilizing our cleaning strategies and have their vessel cleaned. As we're looking at this project management phase, I mean, that becomes part of that whole picture.
And how long do you project out that you'll be involved in this cleanup?
We'll be there as long as the state determines it's necessary. So, you know, the environmental compliance folks and the state regulators will determine when clean is clean. So as the contractor and the maintenance group, they will stay until it's determined clean is clean. Mm-hmm. And now that determination does not come from the responsible party. That determination comes from the state.
Thank you so much. That gives people a good overview of what's involved, and it's very complex. I mean, there are just so many aspects to this, and just in terms of trying to determine the proper cleaning agents for these various elements also involves, you know, tons of regulation, and then you have to dispose of that as well. So,
and huge support. I mean, each one of those cleaning sites is supported by, you know, PPE, you know, personal protective equipment, Tyvek suits, you know, that, porta potties, you know, waste bins for disposing of the hazardous materials, you know, transportation issues, you know, hotel requirements, feeding, you know, just logistically, you know, staging areas, decontamination facilities, supply stations, you know, a whole host of things logistically going to support this. So even, you know, for each particular beach segment, there is a logistical support associated with each one of those beach segments.
Fascinating. Unfortunately, these accidents do happen, and
they're
certainly going to happen in the future again. I'm just curious, as you, with the O'Brien's group, as you look at emerging potential challenges as our Earth is changing here, are there any new types of challenges that you're trying to imagine you may have to deal with?
And with any kind of response, I know Katrina had oil issues associated with the situation that happened with the hurricane. And so as the climate changes and as, you know, you get more flooding or hurricanes, I know the O'Brien's group is still working in a place called Coffeyville, which is located state in the Midwest associated with a flood event. Now, a significant flood in oil on water, and you know the response to that. So, as the climate changes, and you see hurricanes or floods or earthquakes or anything associated with that, there will be other responses associated with that particular natural disaster. We train, put on drills and exercises. We hire subcontractors. We train with those people. So if that situation occurs, we know, I call it likened to being an orchestra director, where you ting the bell and, you know, you point and people respond. And in this response, the music was on key. The response to this incident was exactly as it was intended to be as far as the rules and regulations go. The calls were made. The responsible people responded immediately per the protocols that were in place. And, you know, you have to look at it from a safety standpoint. You know, safety is always the number one concern. So where somebody from the public is not going to run into a burning structure without thinking about their safety, you know, we also do that same thing. So working in a hazardous environment, you know, we respond to the event, and we keep responding to the event until we're told that it's clean and it's done, and then we go home.
We've been talking with Cheryl Surface, who is working with the O'Brien's Group, which is focused directly on the oil spill happening in San Francisco. Cheryl, if people want to find out about the O'Brien's Group, how can they do so?
We actually have a website, theobriensgroup.com, and they're welcome to go there.
Well, good luck in the future here. You got your hands full, and great talking to you, Cheryl.
Thank you.
That's it for this week. As we gather to celebrate Thanksgiving this year, take just a moment to reflect on what a different world we've become since those pilgrims spent their first Thanksgiving with the Native Americans who shared their bounty with the New Worldians who were trying to learn to survive off the earth. As we look to our future, those original sustainable communities deserve a little attention, for they had survived off the land for thousands of years and developed some of the most monumental cultures on earth. Happy Thanksgiving.
Tis the gift to be simple, tis the gift to be free, tis the gift to come down where we ought to be. And when we are in the place just right, we'll be in the valley of love and delight. When true simplicity is gained, to bow and to bend we will not be ashamed. To turn, 'twill be our delight, till by turning, turning we come round, round.
This is Sidney Wildsmith saying adios. Until we meet again next Tuesday or any time on the archives, when your voice of the earth rings out around the world, here on the Wild Side News. Thank you.